In this case, we're going to go back to December 31st of this year, when Burlington Electric found themselves having to respond to something they really didn't expect to have to manage quite in that way. Coming forward for this panel, we're going to have Neil Lunderville, who's the general manager of Burlington Electric Department, Mike Kanarek, who's the director of customer care, community engagement, and communications with Burlington Electric, Jonathan Rajewski, who you've met before from the Leahy Center, Jennifer Vandeveer, who's our local cyber agent with the FBI, and our moderator will be the former U.S. attorney, Eric Miller. So those panelists will be making their way to the stage now.
All right, Jeannie, thank you for that terrific introduction. And in order to keep your attention, we have Russian hacks. We have leaks to the media. We have fake news. And we're not even talking about the latest presidential tweet storm. Instead, we are talking about the supposed hack of the United States electrical grid through Burlington Electric, which, let me make clear, did not happen, and the resulting media firestorm, which very definitely did happen. Before I turn the mic over to BED General Manager Neil Lunderville to set the stage for us, I just wanted to put up on the screen three successive Washington Post headlines to give you a sense of the prominence of this incident and the incredibly fast pace with which it unfolded and things changed. At about 7 p.m. on Friday, December 30th, the Washington Post put this up on its website. Russian hackers penetrate U.S. electricity grid through a utility in Vermont, U.S. officials say. And I can tell you from personal experience, there is not a single utility executive, law enforcement executive, or statewide elected official in Vermont who did not get up from the dinner table because his or her phone was exploding when this hit. The very next morning, the headline changed. Russian operation hacked a Vermont utility, showing risk to grid. And then there was an editor's note in substantially smaller type, noting that they had originally said that the Russian hackers had penetrated the electricity grid, but that no longer appeared to be true. Then, about a day and a half later, third headline, Russian government hackers do not appear to have targeted Vermont utilities, say people close to the investigation. And I think everybody up here expected a fourth headline on the next day, which just said, never mind. But of course, it was a very big deal, particularly for those who were intimately involved in it. We have a great panel here this afternoon to discuss it. Neil, I'm going to ask you to set the stage for us.
Well, thank you, Eric, and hello, comrades. Great to see you here on Friday to talk about this. It was a very interesting endeavor, but to put the whole thing in context, we actually have to go back a little bit. We have to actually go back to the last election, when the Democratic National Committee was hacked. That's where this whole story more or less started. They were hacked, items were released, people resigned. It was a big story. And you know, quickly thereafter came out that folks accused Russia of doing the hack, some kind of maybe state-sponsored, maybe groups within Russia, we don't know, but it was Russia that was behind this. And when the election came, the election went, Trump won, Hillary lost, Democrats certainly started to say very quickly, Russia interfered with this election. Russia was in, packing the DNC, they were creating fake news and pushing that news out to push people away from Secretary of State Clinton in the election, and there was a lot of political back and forth. And this was really starting, really between the election and the new year, this was a very steady drumbeat. And there was also a lot of pressure on then President Obama to do something about it. It wasn't good enough that like it made it happen and you know we'll do better next time. What was the US response gonna be? At one point, Senator John McCain, who was traveling overseas in the Ukraine, was asked about this. He said, hacking the U.S. is an act of war. you know, we need to respond to this. So there was a lot of pressure to respond. And so then kind of fast forward to December 29th, Thursday, December 29th. And the timeline is important here. So on Thursday, December 29th, President Obama took action. He expelled 35, what he called intelligence operatives, Russian intelligence operatives from the United States as part of a package to retaliate against the Russian hacks. The very same day, of course, because for every political action, there has to be an equal and opposite overreaction by the president, the president-elect said, it's time for the country, this is a direct quote, it's time for our country to move on to bigger and better things, basically telling everybody, get over it, this is old news, we're not going to deal with it anymore. So as part of the president, President Obama's response, the very same day, the FBI, in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security, issued what they call a joint analysis report, or a JAR. And in this JAR, it was providing technical details and tools to U.S. organizations to look for what they said were Russian civilian and military intelligence services, ways that they were compromising and exploiting networks as part of this disruption of the U.S. Election. So the FBI was coming out very, very strongly. Russia did it. Be on the lookout for things. In particular, they said, be on the lookout for these indicators of compromise, IOCs, which are a bunch of different pieces of information, including IP addresses that that where Russian hackers could be hacking from or have compromised as part of their hacks. They called this activity Grizzly Step, a very ominous kind of name for this. So this happens. There's, you know, the JAR joint analysis report goes out. BED, Burlington Electric Department, gets this information through an organization called EISEC, which is the Energy Intelligence Sharing Group for utilities. So we get this JAR, and we dutifully put in the different indicators of compromise into our system and start running a scan. We do this around 6 o'clock on Thursday night. So right away, we get the information, we start to run the scan. So far, so good. Overnight, you know, this is a pretty routine thing, by the way. We get these reports time and again, and we implement them and start to look for different indications of compromise. So we start running the scan, and the next morning, one of our employees comes in, and the employee goes to check email, personal email, at yahoo.com. And when the employee went to check the email, it generated IP traffic between the computer the employee was using and yahoo.com. The yahoo.com IP address was one of the indicators of compromise that we saw. So our system, which was doing real-time analysis of our network, intercepted that traffic. Now, it said that, you know, Helen of Troy was the face that launched 1,000 ships. This is the laptop. I did not have this until this very day when the FBI actually gave it back to me. So I figured just 5 minutes before the presentation, I signed over the chain of custody document. So I figured, what a good prop. Here's the laptop that launched 1,000 bad headlines for BED. This was it. And yeah. So from this little Toughbook tablet, Toughpad tablet, the world kind of came to a halt for BED. So we intercepted the traffic. Our IT team went downstairs literally immediately and pulled this out of the dock and preserved it to look at the record. At that point, it was shut down. There was no at no point was there any. Was it ever touching our grid system? So this was on our business network, not the grid network, where it's a completely separate network that runs, actually that keeps the lights on right here, right today. Totally separate network. This was on the billing pieces and other parts of it, of our network. They're separated kind of for this very reason. Once we pulled that from the network, we filed a report. We alerted that EISEC I told you about. And they said, well, it's probably best that you file a report with the Department of Energy is a report called the OE-417. I was looking at it today and I saw a very funny thing. In the upper right-hand corner, it had one of those things, you know, this form shall take you so long to fill out. It's like your tax forms. It says 2.16 hours. I think it actually took us like 2.16 weeks to like deal with this. So we filed this form, and all the form said was that it was suggested that we do this, so we did it. Again, following the rules, it said that we found indicators of compromise based on the joint analysis report, the JAR, indicators of compromise, and we sent it up. Our team had conversations with the FBI and other folks in the federal government, and this was on Friday the 30th. And it was kind of like, well, thanks, you know, we got it. We appreciate you getting the intel to us. We'll take a look at it, and we'll let you know. So from a BED perspective, at 1:44 on Friday afternoon, December 30th, we were like, time for the holiday. And then we went on about our business. But meanwhile, in Washington, this story was continuing to play out. So what happened is that there was a political tit-for-tat that continued to brew in Washington. And where the day before, U.S. expels 35 people, the next day, Putin issues a statement and says, we will not immediately hit the U.S. back. We're not going to engage in this tit-for-tat. And President-elect Trump issues a tweet. It was actually at 11:44 in the morning, so it wasn't the wee small hours, but he said, great move on delay by V. Putin. Always knew he was very smart. So there is a strong tension right now saying, where you've got the president-elect basically saying, Russia has nothing to do with this. You got the leader who's smart, and you know, don't worry about it. Get over it. This is not a big story. So somewhere in Washington, our OE-417 form is floating around down there. We don't exactly know where it floated, but we know when we sent it to the Department of Energy, FBI got a copy, Department of Homeland Security got a copy, but we think it also might have went to the White House. And at the White House, there was, quote, a senior administration official who looked at this report and not understanding anything about it said, oh my God, the Russians have infiltrated the electric grid. And that's really what they thought. And they went out to the press room, very likely, and they found Juliet Ellepern, who is the White House bureau chief, not the cybersecurity reporter, but the White House political reporter for the Washington Post. And I think the reporter got it and said, oh my God, I've got the story of the week right here. Went back to Washington Post, they banged out a story, they never called their cybersecurity reporter. And at 7:55 that night, they posted the very first story that Eric put up.
Neil, did they call BED before posting that story?
Well, they posted the story at 7:55, and the first phone call that we got was at 8:05. So I had an opportunity to ask the managing editor of the Washington Post, why didn't you call us before? And he said, we didn't know it was you. I said, there's only two utilities in this area that it could be. That's kind of not a good enough reason. And then he asked me probably one of the great questions of all time. He said, what would you have done if you were in my spot and you had a story like this on Friday night? Uh-huh. And I said, I didn't go to journalism school, but I'm pretty sure I would have made sure the story was right before I posted it. But the story goes up, and just as Eric said, the phones start going off. And I'm going to let Mike pick up the story and what happened with our press piece of it. But we received that call at 8:05. We didn't get the message until a little bit later. I got a call from another utility. The question that I got from the utility was, has your grid been hacked? And I said, I don't think so. You know, I at this point was enjoying myself on a Friday before New Year's. You can use your imagination what that means. And I put two and two together and said, uh-oh, this has something to do with this report we filed. And at the time, I didn't know. I mean, we knew the indicators of compromise were found. I didn't know if it was something more, and they just hadn't told us yet, or it had been conflated into something bigger. Obviously, it was the latter, not the former. I was at a party very close to Burlington Electric. with my better half, Denise Casey, her and I said, we got to go. We got to go right now. Luckily, she's a public affairs expert herself. And so I got in touch with Mike. Mike will pick up his story there. But we sat down to try to get a statement out very quickly. We arrived at the office at 8:30. I got the facts together, and we issued our statement basically saying that what the Washington Post reported didn't happen at 9:27. So within an hour of kind of arriving at the office and getting our feet on the ground. And from there begins this massive saga of trying to unring the bell that was so widely rung. Maybe I'll stop there.
That's a great background. Now, tell me, Neil, when did you, we know from Jennifer's presence up here, and by the way, you heard a couple of our prior speakers talk about the Vermont cyber agent. Jennifer's is the friendly face that you will see should you be in the situation of having to call them. But Neil, when did you guys make the decision to bring law enforcement into the loop on this?
When we filed our form on Friday, law enforcement was in the loop during that process.
Did you then circle back with them after the headline hit, or did they circle back with you after the headline
the
hit?
Yeah, the latter. Okay. I mean, we were trying to, on Friday night, it was a situation where we were in full damage control mode, and we knew at that point, we had figured out there wasn't an issue. I mean, we had not been hacked. Our grid was never in danger. Although when I got to Burlington Electric and I went up to the control room, I had a wide-eyed control. Our operator, our dispatcher is there. Are we being hacked? I've gotten calls from reporters saying we've been hacked. And I said, has anything changed? And he's like, no. I said, you're not being hacked. Don't worry about it. But it was really on Saturday morning when we began to work really closely with the Bureau and other federal authorities to kind of get our arms around what happened.
So let me ask, let's put off Mike's media response for just a second and talk for a few minutes about the criminal investigation and how you got pulled in, how things changed when the press picked this up, Jennifer, and then ask John to talk about the Leahy Center's role in the investigation. Before we do that, Mike and Neil have some sort of magic trick planned for the end of this. And so we're going to be passing around an attractive BED hat and ask you to put business cards in it. And at the end, I assume we'll all understand why we're doing this, Mike. Is that right?
Yeah, and if you don't have a card, just write your name on a piece of paper, and
we don't want to leave anybody out.
You make sure you put it in there.
But with that commercial interruption behind us, Jennifer, tell us about how you became involved in the first instance, and then how the nature of your response changed once this thing kind of caught fire in the media.
Absolutely. So I think Neil mentioned that BED filed that form around 1 o'clock or so on Friday. By about 3 o'clock, it had worked its way from our Albany office, which is the office that oversees me, back to me. And it's basically said, hey, FYI, this thing came in, just check it out. So I looked over the form, and it didn't have a lot of information on it. So I immediately called over to Burlington Electric, and I said, hi, I'm Jennifer from the FBI. I just got a form. I'm just checking in, like, to see more details about exactly what you filed on. And I talked to some of the tech people there, and they explained pretty clearly about the alert based on the jar, and that they had checked, and they thought it was a Yahoo website. And I asked the usual questions. What network was this? How many systems were involved? Was the network connected to any compromises or any other systems? What is the status of the computer now? And I was able to pretty easily determine, based on those initial phone calls, that this wasn't an emergency situation. There was an indicator, and I wanted to find out more because it was connected to this Grizzly Steps jar that may be of value to us in looking at potentially what systems might have been trying to connect to Burlington Electric, but it wasn't an ongoing incident. There wasn't an active problem. So I said to them, it's a holiday weekend, how about I set up a time next week for me to come by and I'll take a look at the system. Would you be willing to let me image it and scan it for our reference just to get a look at it? And they all said, yeah, that would be no problem. It's on a shelf here. Just let us know when you plan on coming by. So it's Friday afternoon before New Year's Eve, and I said, that's great. I'll see you next week. And I went home. And it was all good. I'd sent my message down to Albany. Yeah, I checked it out. Going to stop by next week, doesn't look like there's anything here. And we were all good. And then I'm sitting on the couch. I wasn't at a party. Sorry, my life is not as exciting as Neil.
It was a small party.
And And my husband, who's here actually listening, says to me, oh, my mom just sent this thing. Do you know about anything going on at Burlington Electric? And this is about 8:15. And I said, what? Burlington Electric? What is it? And I read the article from the Washington Post, and I'm just sitting there going, what is this? How did they get this? And I'm just shocked. And I immediately responded by saying, okay, I need to let the people in my office know, because they think that nothing happened here, and they're going to read this and think, what is Jennifer doing up there? The Russians have just hacked Burlington Electric, and she's at home on the couch. So I immediately start reaching back out to my office and say, hey, I checked this out today. This was my initial response. Please be aware of this headline. Make sure people know. I don't know what's going on, but it looks like this is very big in the press. At the same time, I made some calls back to the people at Burlington Electric that I had spoken to earlier, and I left some messages, and I said, hi, this is the FBI. I just saw this article in the Washington Post. If anything comes up, or if you need to call back to me, I have my cell phone on me all night. Please just reach out. And so I let them know, we're here. Call us if you need us. Now, I didn't have Neil's number directly, because my initial response didn't involve Neil, because it was small. So I didn't end up connecting to Neil until the following morning. But over the course of the evening, as you can see by the headlines, this just got bigger and bigger and a little bit crazier. So what started out as I'll be there next week was by, 8 o'clock in the morning when I finally did talk to you, hey, do you mind if I come by right now? So at about 8 or 9 the following morning, I was at Burlington Electric with Neil, getting ready to figure out how we were going to answer all the questions that needed to be answered right away, because that was the point where I no longer had time to get answers, and we no longer had time to relax and just figure out what this was. We needed to both answer the questions and make sure that everybody who needed to give those answers out had the information, and that it was very accurate information, because there was no room at this point for there to be inaccurate information. So that was really the priority at that point, is get very accurate information very quickly. And I'll talk a little more about that after. I want to move on to the press response that Burlington Electric was going through.
Before we leave you, Jen, I imagine you get called into a lot of organizations, and they have widely varying degrees of preparedness.
Yes.
For an incident like this. At risk of having you put the folks at BED on the spot, tell me about what you found when you got there in terms of their preparedness and the steps they had taken both leading up to and in the immediate aftermath.
Well, their preparedness was apparent to me based on those initial phone calls. I called up and I immediately spoke to an IT person who understood my questions. So I was able to get information very quickly that showed that they had taken what seemed like the very reasonable and appropriate steps to both evaluate the situation and make sure that they weren't in a position of still having an ongoing compromise. So they were prepared, and they had also taken the additional step of reporting the information. So they had done everything right, from what I could tell. And the reality of the situation is that even when you do everything right, sometimes something goes askew, right? Murphy's Law. So they were very prepared, and they had done exactly the right things, and we just all found ourselves in an incident that we were dealing with because this stuff happens.
So we've talked a lot about private-public partnerships during the course of the conversation today. Although the one that you put together to help investigate this is unique, I think, or at least not of the type that we typically talk about. John, can you talk to us about the role the Leahy Center played working with the FBI in as much detail as you're able to talk about to the crew today?
Sure. So it's New Year's Day, approximately 9:12, making an espresso. I get a call from Neil saying, I need you here now. So Neil and I have known each other in the past. I direct the Leahy Center here at Champlain College. We provide professional services to local organizations that need help. So in this situation, they need help. So I, finished my espresso, got in the car, and grabbed a bag of equipment and responded to Burlington Electric. I expected personally to see a wall of media trucks. That wasn't the case. It was kind of interesting, even though this is all over the news. So in responding, my first job when getting there is try to understand what's going on, try to identify potential evidence, because we knew it was going on. I saw the news, but I didn't really know the true internal nature of what was done so far, what was collected. So my job on scene was to try to collect the digital evidence in a way that could be used in a court of law. So I was trying to collect network data, network logs. What was the alert? How did you learn about this? Which devices are involved? So I collected the evidence.
Jennifer, is it typical in your line of work to be working with somebody like Jonathan during the evidence-gathering portion of an investigation?
Yeah, so we had two different roles here. My role as the government was to collect the evidence so that we could use it. But at the same time, a lot of times you'll respond to a large company that has their own IT staff and they want to be conducting their evidence. And so in this circumstance, Champlain College was playing the role of the internal investigation for Burlington Electric so that they could have copies of all of the evidence that the FBI was collecting for whatever purpose they needed. So it was a situation where they wanted to get a copy, and it's certainly their right to get a copy, but we also wanted to make sure that evidence was preserved for us to have a copy as well that would stand up. So John and I were working pretty closely and talking with our computer scientists down in Albany to make sure that anything that he did to the device wasn't going to alter any of the evidence that we needed, so that everything could be collected and any evidence that would be there would be preserved.
And I think this is important to note because it really adds a significant degree of difficulty to both parties' investigations. You've got an investigation being performed by the FBI for the purposes of investigating and maybe prosecuting a criminal case. You've got an internal investigation being performed by the victim organization, both for its own lesson learning process, and of course to establish civil liability on the part of any other actor should it come to that down the road. And I can't imagine that it's easy to coordinate these things, but it's absolutely integral to do them to the best of your abilities. Yeah. So, Mike, main event. And let me add a little context here so that the rest of us don't feel too inadequate as we look at the response that BED mustered. First of all, before he was the general manager of BED, Neil Lunderville held many significant leadership roles in state government and in politics, and as a result had a lot of crisis management and media experience. Mike Kanarek, who's their communications director, is a former federal prosecutor, as well as a chief of staff to prominent elected officials who has handled their communications and relations with the media for many years. And just so those of us who don't have that kind of resume don't feel too bad, as we listened to what you have to say about your response, with that introduction, tell us what comes next from a media point of view.
Well, thanks for that introduction. And, despite those impressive comments that can embarrass someone, I'm like everyone else. It was Friday night, December 30th, and I was home with my family, in fact, hosting a Hanukkah party. It was the seventh night of Hanukkah at the Kanarek household, 25 people running around. And I brought some props, too. I wanted to kind of give you a feel for what was going on there at our house. When I had to really focus, let's see, let me just get this set, I'll just take a moment. Potato latkes, fresh from Price Chopper today. And we were enjoying one of our favorite Vermont beers, Heady Topper. People were running around, the menorahs were lit, we were having a good time, and suddenly, I have two cell phones, a work phone and a personal phone, and it's probably like 10 after 8, and my work phone is plugged in on the counter charging where it often is on a Friday night at 8 o'clock, and my personal phone's in my pocket because I'm taking pictures like a good dad, and my personal phone starts to ring, and you know, it's WCAX calling, and it's, you know, Free Press calling, and I think, what the heck's going on? We're literally in the middle of lighting multiple menorahs, which is a neat thing you do. You have everyone bring their menorah. So I'm like, all right, I'll see what's going on in just a minute. So I walk over to where the work phone is, and there's missed call after missed call. And as I'm looking to figure out what's going on, Neil calls. And it took off from there. And the moment I figured out what was happening from talking to Neil, I informed my wife, who's awesome and wonderful, you know, Liz, I'm going to need to step out of our party for a little while and take care of of a work matter. And the point of this here in talking about media response and crisis communications is that you do need to push aside all of that fun stuff you might be doing and focus on the task at hand. And so we had lots of individual media inquiries, not only from our local media, but from some national media as well. But what's important to Neil and myself and Burlington Electric is thinking about our community and what are they thinking? Is this news making it out into the public, even though it's a Friday night and not as many people are paying attention? And so we wanted to let the people of Burlington and beyond know that everything was okay. This is serious business. And oftentimes, if you get an inquiry from the media, you may get back to that individual media person. In this instance, when you're flooded with media inquiries, what you want to do is put together a statement and try to get the facts out there accurately and try to get them out there quickly. And so, you know, now it's 8:30-ish, 8:45 in the evening. Neil and his significant other are at Burlington Electric. I'm out on our porch with my laptop, and we're working on a statement and trying to make sure we had facts gathered. We had heard from friends of ours at Green Mountain Power who have similar jobs because they had been hearing what was going on. And we worked hard to, by 9:27, put out a statement, and we have a media list that we use. And in fact, even though we couldn't get back to each individual media outlet, we were hearing from other media outlets we don't ordinarily hear from. We're not usually responding to the national media or sending our Burlington Electric press releases out to them. So we were very careful to make sure that anyone who had inquired heard back from us as well to get this, to get this statement out to them that basically says everything's okay in Burlington. Burlington Electric was not hacked. And that's where we went from there.
Jennifer said earlier, and I think it's exactly right, you did not, it was extraordinarily important that whatever you put out be 100% correct at this point, right? Because you're already in a position where everybody thinks you've been hacked. If you put out something that's wrong, your credibility is going to be severely damaged. But because of the way this came about, you hadn't been able to do a full-scale investigation by the time you put out your statement. How did you deal with, on the one hand, the need for a rapid response, and on the other hand, the need to make darn sure it's 100% accurate?
It's a great question, and it's really important. There are sometimes in organizations, I know folks are here from different organizations, there are certain folks in the organization who wonder, what the heck are the media people doing? They're looking at one phrase of one sentence and they keep changing one word. Come on already. Like, you know, what's going on here? Let's get the thing out. Every word matters because of what Eric just said. You want to make sure that everything is accurate. And in fact, even though we knew we hadn't been hacked and we wanted to be as definitive and decisive as possible, we didn't know everything yet. Yet we needed to get a statement out. So if you looked at the different iterations of our short statement and saw how it evolved, it may or may not be interesting. It was to us. But we tried to be as forceful and decisive as we could while not going too far because we didn't want to have to pull back. In part, Eric mentioned we want to look out for the reputation of Burlington Electric. But honestly, more importantly, we wanted to get it right for the good of the folks who are hearing about the news, particularly our Burlingtonians. So we labor over even short media statements like that, particularly in a scenario as important as this.
I'll just pick up on that. One thing that was really important is to make sure that our customers knew that there wasn't a Red Dawn scenario going on in Burlington. I mean, the local paper here, the daily paper, Free Press, some of their early headlines were very, they were wrong. I mean, they were flat out wrong. And we actually, after we put the statement out, between Mike and I, we spent probably 2 full hours trying to chase down local headlines that were wrong and correct those stories. And we had Russian hackers strike Burlington Electric. That is an improvement over the original headline, which was Russians attack Burlington Electric.
Attack. That was what, if you had looked, if you had looked online that night, that's what was on the website.
Right. And it did take, quite literally, me on the phone with the editor, Mike on the phone with the publisher out of Albany at 11 o'clock at night.
Woke him.
Yeah, having a what we might call a robust conversation about the editorial guidelines of the paper, and I think eventually they appreciate, and I appreciate that they did listen to us. They changed it. I wish it had been better still, because I think Strike is, it was still, as I was arguing with Attack, I said, Attack is like, they're having swords, and it's not like that. but we didn't want, I mean, here we are, it's, you know, 25 degrees out, you're in the end of December. We have customers who are watching CNN, seeing that our grid is under attack. And as I was telling the press that night, and as was Mike, this is yelling fire in a crowded theater. This is not happening. And the press said, well, you know, you are on fire, though. And I'm like, no, we're not. And they're like, well, how can we believe you? I'm like, you'd have to, why would I lie about it? But because I have a, you know, I'm an officer of this company, a fiduciary responsibility to our customers. They need to know we're not under attack. And I think ultimately that argument did win the day after some jousting, but that was as important to us as the media part of it, was to make sure that our customers knew. So kind of my final point was, in addition to putting a news release out, we also worked with our social media expert, Destiny Vital, who was kind of the fourth member of our team, and she was hitting it out on Twitter, out on Facebook, and putting it on our website. So that with folks going through their social media networks, they were seeing a reaffirming statement from us that, you know, it was not as you were watching on CNN, but in fact, the real story was we were just fine.
And what's interesting, don't forget, you know, the bell had been rung, but 7:55 is when the Washington Post first posted the story online. I found a voicemail on my work phone from 8:05 later on that evening, after I had probably had about 25 or 30 messages, you know,
from
on your phone.
From the Washington Post calling you?
The one from the Washington Post. Yeah. The 25 or 30 from the various media outlets on that Friday night. And as I said, you're working to put a statement together. I learned from my counterpart at Green Mountain Power, they too had gotten a call just a couple minutes before we did from the Washington Post, also after it published the story. You know, they remember this all happened because of the Post's story, which they didn't even try to verify with us before. And when the gentleman said to Neil, what would you have done? Well, they knew what to do. They called Green Mountain Power and Burlington Electric shortly after they posted the story. Yet, you know, think about what would have happened if they had done that before. We would have said, goodness, no, that's, you know, hang on a minute, that's not what happened. But it did happen. And then, importantly, once we got the word out, we were working Saturday, this became an 8-day process. It went clear through to the next Friday. Neil and I basically spent all of our time between Friday night, the 30th of December, and the following Friday working on this. And one thing we were doing was getting Neil to have an interview with anyone who reached out, whether it was CNN by Skype on Saturday, the day after it happened, or a cybersecurity blog where the blogger had reached out. We wanted to be communicating with everybody to make sure that the right story was out there, the accurate story. And interestingly, even when you do that, despite what I will humbly say are very thorough efforts on our part to get the facts out there, the story can still continue. Without naming names, a certain US senator from a neighboring state 10 days later was in a Senate confirmation hearing to question John Kelly before he became the Homeland Security Director. And the quote from that senator was, I want to start with a question on cybersecurity that has hit my neck of the woods in the past couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post reported that a hacking group connected with the Russian government managed to infiltrate the Burlington Electric Power Company in Vermont. So you've got a Senate confirmation hearing happening on January 10th, you know, 11 days later at the highest levels of federal government, and the story is still not quite right.
Now, the durability of the false narrative, I think, amazed all of us at the time, but in retrospect, given the durability of the Russian hacking narrative and the way in which this fits so neatly into it, I'm confident that that, in the end, was responsible for at least part of the longevity of this storyline, despite your best efforts and really good efforts to knock it down.
There is this phenomenon in politics and in the media. If something, I mean, that the story about Russians infiltrating the grid fit the narrative perfectly. It was perfect. It was the perfect story for the president-elect saying Russia has nothing to do with it, the Obama administration saying Russia's in the middle of it, and here's this hot piece of evidence that happens to be totally untrue. But it was so good that nobody could pass it up. And I think that's what the managing editor of the Post was saying to me, what would you have done? It wasn't so much a, really the truth of the question was not about what would I have done as an editor. It's like, you know, buddy, I'm like looking a Pulitzer in the eye here. You know? What would you have done? And having never looked a Pulitzer in the eye, I guess I would have made the call, make sure. But it is fascinating how us, a little utility here in Burlington, Vermont, gets swept up in this international crisis. I will say we did do, I think Mike Field did 100 calls. I did 50 interviews on this topic. I know it like I know my own name now, all the details, because I've recounted them so many times. The one outlet we didn't get back to was TASS, the Russian outlet, who did call us and say, we heard the Washington Post screwed this up, and blaming the Russians, we want you to, you know, we said, probably not going to respond to that one.
we had joked about, you know, when are we going to hear from TASS, and, you know, like 2 hours after we joked about it, I came running over to Neil and said, you got to hear this voice.
you did work really well with an author from Forbes magazine, though, who wrote one or two really long pieces, not just on the incident, but on what we're talking about today. That is, how a false storyline got legs and was perpetuated throughout, you know, throughout many different media over the course of many weeks.
That's right. A gentleman named Caleb Litaru, who's a reporter for Forbes, wrote two dynamite stories on January 1st and January 2nd. So it was like the Sunday, Monday following all this. And he really was digging deep into what the Washington Post did wrong and what they caused. And it was really interesting. And we tried to kind of get that story out there. When we saw the first story, we were in touch with this reporter. And in terms of like lessons learned for folks out here who deal with the media, some of what you've heard, you know, overall, it's important for organizations to have good relationships with the media. And we work hard to do that. And it's good to know that you can reach out to them and call them on what they're doing in a respectful way and say, look, that headline really doesn't seem right. And you learn about when headlines online are going to get printed and become the real headline the next day. And it's all about the timing and working with the media, trying to develop friends in the media. Again, not to work the media and be slick, but to make sure accurate reporting occurs. And so we worked with Caleb on his second story to get him information that he might need. And also, some things to remember in addition are when we were dealing with these, you know, 50 interviews and 100 media calls, I tried on every one of them to say something like, Jen, I'm so glad you did call. It's too bad I'm getting to meet you over a story like this. Did you know Burlington Electric was a utility in Burlington, the first city in the nation to source 100% of our power from renewable generation? Really? And we laid the groundwork for some future stories with some national media outlets. And
that's the sign of a good PR man right there.
Right, but that's, you know, I don't want to just spend all the time getting back to the cyber blogger. You know, they're not the one that's going to do the 100% renewable story, but you pick and choose who you're talking to. But, you know, we tried to make each contact an opportunity.
Jennifer, I want to come back to you for a second. Normally, in the course of a criminal investigation, law enforcement gets really nervous when their victims, who are also potential witnesses, are out there talking to the press about an incident. Did you have any concerns about that in this case? And if so, how did you manage to work through those?
Well, this all happened really fast, so there wasn't a lot of time to really hash this out as we normally would in an investigation where you're really working closely and saying, you know, maybe it get called, there's other things that are going to happen. We came in very quickly, and as I had said, I expected to be in there the following week with a computer scientist with me to really get the facts. And we were in a position where we needed to get facts quickly and not necessarily prepared to get all those facts. So what we were really dealing with was both trying to conduct a very, very rapid investigation and also in a situation where both Neil and Mike were both sitting there asking me, give us facts, give us information. We want to put out a press release. And when we're in that situation, we are certainly, as you've heard throughout the evening, we certainly are aware of the victims in the situation, that they have very, very different problems that they're dealing with than us, who are just trying to figure out who did it. So it was a balance at that point, where I was sitting down, we had multiple meetings over the course of the few hours that I was there, where they would say, what do you know? What do you know? And the answer was really, mostly I know what you told me at this point. Because the honest point was I hadn't had a chance to get the device and have someone who could really look at it answer the questions. But I also was able to sit down and say, when they were throwing back and forth, we want to say this, we want to say this, I was able to say, well, that may not be quite correct, or possibly you don't want to say that. And I was also able to put them in touch with our national press office, who is our office that does the outreach to the media. And they were able to offer a little guidance on what the FBI was going to be able to say in that situation as well. And I think Neil's, the line that he likes to joke about is, I can't tell them that the FBI's involved.
they kept saying, what can I not say? And Gavin kept saying, FBI. You could say federal authorities. And so the press would be like, so is the FBI involved? Well, the federal authorities have been really involved in the, you know, just kind of giving these mistakes. I will on this, and the FBI was great. The federal government got a bad rap in this because one person made a bad decision to leak something and not understanding it. But it's not a rap on the federal government, it's a rap on one person. Because the Bureau, DHS, DOE, and all the other acronyms that we dealt with handled themselves exceptionally, professionally, and with a high level of expertise. And one question I've got is, well, this, is this going to make BED or energy companies less likely to deal with the federal government because you're afraid this will happen again? And the answer is unequivocally no. We will certainly always work with our federal partners, because our federal partners are our conduit to the intelligence that is helping us protect our networks. We don't have our own intelligence team. We don't have our own set of Navy SEALs going in and getting intelligence somewhere. That'd be interesting if we did, but to be honest, we need the federal government to help us monitor threats, and they need us to monitor those threats and report back the information. So this has not had a chilling effect at all. If anything, I hope it's had a chilling effect on political operatives being dumb in leaking information and trying to be the big person on campus, because you can get it wrong. When you get it wrong like this, you have almost cataclysmic consequences. But our federal partners did an exceptional job, and I think if anything, it strengthened our relationship with them, and that's the silver lining, if you will, that's come out of this.
And I'd like to add one more thing about, since people in the audience may be wondering, well, what actually happened? What did you do? I mean, you showed up there and there was this device there. It took a little while, but because this was suddenly the most popular device in the country at the time, we had some very, very smart people go through it with a very, very fine-tooth comb. So multiple agencies have looked at that thing and found everything that possibly could be found on it and done some extensive reports. And although we don't release that to the public and we don't make public statements about that stuff, we did come to the conclusion as a group that the Russians did not hack Burlington Electric. we didn't make that statement at the time. It took a little while for all those analyses to be done, but that was the conclusion that finally came out of it.
Yeah, I can say, because the federal authorities might not be able to say, but I can say that they found nothing. I mean, we could plug it in right now and use it. And it hasn't been turned on since the day it was pulled off the network.
Well, we turned it on.
Yeah, I don't know what you put on. We're just kidding. I'm just teasing.
That strikes me as a great place to end the conversation, except for any questions that the audience have. We have time for probably two or three of those before we need to move on. We have one right down in front here. Oh, could bring the mic around front.
Quick question about the information, the IP address that belonged to the Yahoo servers. Was that an improperly typed IP address, or was it really part of that jar?
I can answer that question. It was part of the jar, but, and I'm not an expert in this, and Jennifer, you can add context to this, but a lot of experts said that the jar ended up being a too overly broad, and so that the indicators of compromise, that cast too wide of a net. So in fact, our employee hadn't really done anything, and really, we don't really know that the employee clicked on something, or if it was just traffic that was generated from a pop-up ad, or we don't really know. I mean, I'm not really sure we've recreated that at this point. But it ended up, you know, it's Yahoo. It's not exactly like something deep in Siberia. It's a pretty well-known address, but I think the critiques kind of after the fact said that the jar probably offered too broad a guidance or too broad of indicators of compromise, and we got caught up in that. I don't know if you have...
I mean, I can't speak to sort of anything behind the jar, but I can say that the indicator that they found was in the jar, yeah. And we did find that indicator when we looked at it.
Any other questions?
I'm actually not heading towards the mic.
Question back there.
Hi, name's Brian Waters. So first, I just want to say I'm kind of relieved to find out that the leak came from the White House, because that means that the sort of, I guess, line level agencies, if you will, that dealt with this were in fact, professional and kept this confidential information confidential. So, to all of you who worked on that, thank you very much. So I don't think I have a question so much as a comment, and it's sort of towards what you just spoke about with the jar there. So the jar came out, I think it was the day or a few days before Friday, and I looked at it, and a number of other security researchers looked at it, and for example, I found that there were, I think, 800 IP addresses, and half of them had been Tor exit nodes at one point or another. So if you don't know what that is, it's a fairly generic thing on the internet, right? And many of the other IP addresses belong to places like Yahoo, service providers. I think Linode was on there. So with this event here at Burlington Electric being leaked to the press, obviously I'm not privy to what goes on behind the scenes, but I can only assume that there were other reports filed with US CERT and DHS and FBI and DOE and anyone else who worked on it that were not leaked. And so I imagine that there were many false positives. And so I guess my comment is that I think this is sort of the story behind the story. And so I hope that this community, the sort of law enforcement community, is having a conversation about that, because it strikes me as problematic. That's my comment. Thank you.
Neil, quick final word?
I did have one quick comment. It wasn't mentioned here, but I think was maybe implied. There is a saying in public relations that no comment is not an option. And I think that's very much a lesson with this. If you have an organization where you could be in our scenario, whether it's a real or imagined hack, you have to be ready to say something. Because we heard that from a lot of reporters who said to us, hey, thank you for talking. Because this happens a lot in companies, either don't report it, or after it's reported, will say no comment. And it makes the matters worse, because you end up kind of drawing the press and people draw their own conclusions. And although we have to be very careful what we said, which was why it was great to have communication professionals and the FBI working with us on that, we knew that if we said nothing, the story would grow to epic. It grew to epic proportions, but it would have been 20x of what it was had we just clammed up and locked the doors and said, we'll talk to you on Tuesday after the new year. So you have to be prepared and have a plan to at least say something. And that's a really important lesson out of this.
Jen?
And I just have a bit of a sales pitch, since I've decided that since I am the cyber agent for the FBI in Vermont, I am the cyber division for the FBI in the state of Vermont. So if you have a problem in the state of Vermont, you can call the cyber division. I'll answer. But I also want to let everybody know that the cyber division of the state of Vermont is growing. We've brought in, state police is now on board. We're going to have a state police investigator working on this with us as well. And we're going to be working hard to grow our ability to respond and get take calls from Vermonters. I get calls all the time from one- and two-person companies, getting everything from phishing emails to ransomware, and I talk to all of them, and we deal with all of them. And honestly, that's the bulk of what I'm dealing with, is these small problems from small businesses. But it's not a small problem if the business is small enough, and we're certainly aware of that, and we're going to do our best to help everybody in every way we can. So call the cyber division. I'm here to help.
All right. Thank you, panel.